Good day. Today is Tuesday, 24th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, the last 24 hours have continued to be dominated in terms of news reporting by President Trump's extraordinary series of statements. His statement on Friday that he was going to impose a 48-hour ultimatum on Iran, requiring Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz, and saying that if Iran did not open the Strait of Hormuz in that time, then the United States would obliterate its entire energy industry. And then, of course, early yesterday, late on Sunday night in Britain, to be precise, there was the statement by President Trump that, in fact, he was postponing implementation of that ultimatum by 5 days in light of successful negotiations which had supposedly taken place between Iran and the United States, supposedly leading towards a negotiated settlement of that conflict. I said at the start of my program yesterday that I didn't believe in the truth of these negotiations at all. They seem to me to completely contradict all of the statements that had been coming out of Tehran. And I thought that President Trump's comments were extraordinarily vague about the negotiations, and vague in such a way that they cast doubt on the whole idea that negotiations were taking place at all. And, well, the Iranians themselves, as I also discussed in my programme yesterday, issued denial after denial over the course of yesterday, denying that negotiations of the sort that Donald Trump had been claiming were taking place were taking place. And yet, to my bafflement, most of the media, in the West at least, continued to discuss Donald Trump's claim that negotiations were taking place as if that was actually what was happening, as if that was in fact the truth. And throughout the day yesterday, I read report after report about Pakistan and its role in conducting mediation between the United States and Iran, about telephone conversations that had taken place between the chief of staff of the Pakistani military and senior US officials, extending all the way to the president himself, of the fact that the Pakistani leadership has been talking to President Pezeshkian of Iran. That is true, by the way. They have. But this has been a regular occurrence throughout this entire 3 weeks of the fighting. And as I've previously pointed out, Pakistan and Iran actually have friendly relations with each other, or have done so up to now. Anyway, people were jumping to all sorts of conclusions about these calls. There were rumours that Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner were going to Pakistan, or were actually in Pakistan, and that they were waiting to meet, and perhaps were intending to meet Iranian officials there. The president himself, Donald Trump, continued to insist in various meetings and discussions that he'd had with the media that there had in fact been negotiations with the Iranians and that these negotiations had been going well. He floated the absolutely bizarre idea that control of the Strait of Hormuz might be shared, not by Iran and the United States exactly, but by himself personally and the Ayatollah. It was completely unclear to me which Ayatollah he meant, or if he did in fact mean any Ayatollah specifically. I say that because he seems to have rejected all suggestions of negotiations and dialogue with the actual supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Muqtada Khamenei, who is of course the son of the Ayatollah Khamenei, the previous supreme leader, who was killed by Israel, together with many other Iranian officials, on the first day of the current conflict, on the 28th of February. Anyway, Trump came up with this completely bizarre proposal, but anyway, he continued to insist that there'd been negotiations and that negotiations were indeed taking place. And everybody, or so it seemed to me, the media was scratching their heads trying to figure out how the negotiations had happened, who had been meeting and talking to whom, what sort of discussions had taken place alongside Pakistan. There was a lot of discussion about the role of India, Egypt, Turkey, Britain, all sorts of countries that supposedly were conveying messages between the United States and Iran leading up to negotiations. And the United States, the president himself, was talking about Speaker Ghalibaf, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, as being the person who would be conducting the negotiations on the Iranian side, the pragmatist who would take charge of Iran, the Delcy Rodriguez, if you like, of Iran, who the United States would be able to negotiate with and who they would work with and who was standing ready to take over. And it was extremely frustrating to me to listen and to watch all of this, because firstly, it was entirely ignoring the fact that the Iranians, in one statement after another, over the course of yesterday, were insisting that no negotiations of any kind were taking place. There'd be no direct discussions between the United States and Iran. Iran had been contacted by various countries at various points during the conflict. These countries, which by the way include Russia, the one country that I noticed was never mentioned yesterday, have all offered their good services as potential mediators. And several of these countries have indeed passed messages from the United States to Iran and have received messages back. But the Iranians were adamant throughout the day, saying that there were no negotiations had taken place, either directly or via these mediators. That the Iranian response throughout the various contacts, the Iranian response whenever a message was received via third parties, mediators, intermediaries, whoever, to the United States, was that Iran has set out its conditions. It is for the United States to satisfy those conditions that Iran is not interested in anything less, that it is not prepared to debate ceasefires or anything of that kind. That is not something that is of any interest to Iran at all, at least not at this time. So the media mostly were ignoring all of that, and as I said, were chasing around trying to put together the story of negotiations, which, to say it straightforwardly, I don't believe have ever taken place. I don't believe are going to take place anytime soon. I think that the media yesterday spent all its time chasing a mirage, a fiction that the President of the United States placed before them. Now, I say all of this, I say this with some difficulty. I am still challenged to imagine a world where the President of the United States could invent an entire fictitious negotiation, publicize it in a Truth Social post, in a public statement, in the way that Donald Trump did, repeat it throughout the day, even as the evidence, or the evidence that it was a fiction, was there for everyone to see. I still struggle to imagine a world in which something like that takes place. This is not because the United States government has an impeccable story, a history of telling the truth. Quite the contrary, in fact. My memory extends all the way back to the 1960s, and I remember many occasions, regular instances, when the United States has either not told the truth or not told the whole truth or has misrepresented facts and given distorted accounts of things. But something quite as brazen as what took place yesterday is, I admit, new to me, but I've come to realise, since Donald Trump was inaugurated President of the United States in January last year, that this is what he does. That this is not what he does all of the time, but what he does a lot of the time. And when the evidence clearly points in a different direction from what he says, one should disregard what he says and stick with the evidence. Now, to repeat again, the Iranians, including Speaker Ghalibaf, are insisting that there be no negotiations or talks with the United States. By this morning, it was clear, or at least increasingly clear, to more and more people, even in the media, I think, that there have been no talks between Iran and the United States. That yesterday's big story was a non-story. It was a story about something that wasn't happening. But remarkably, incredibly, even whilst the media were focused on this non-story, this completely made-up story, they were ignoring the things in the conflict which are actually taking place, which point in a completely different direction, not towards peace talks, but towards continuing escalation. And escalation, it should be stressed, which is entirely unrelated to President Trump's earlier 48-hour ultimatum, or his later decision to call it off. For example, when President Trump did call off his ultimatum, he said that there would be no further strikes by the United States upon energy facilities in Iran. The United States had imposed upon itself a unilateral restriction upon itself doing so. Well, a few hours later, even whilst this five-day prohibition of strikes on energy systems in Iran was supposed to be in effect, I read reports about an airstrike upon an Iranian gas facility inside Iran. In other words, another attack on the Iranian energy system. Of course, there is always some uncertainty about whether strikes of this kind are conducted by the Israeli Air Force or by the US Air Force. But to my mind, it makes no effective difference. The president is clearly leading an alliance of two countries against Iran. Those two countries are Israel and the United States. It's increasingly clear to me that these two countries are indeed working very closely together. And it seems to me that what happens is that when the president wants to cover for something that is done of a kinetic nature against Iran itself, he has the convenient device of saying it's not the United States that's carrying out this attack, it's the Israelis. He did this with the attack on the South Pars gas field, and he did this again yesterday when he said that the United States is not going to carry out attacks on Iran's gas facilities. Only an attack shortly after did take place, and I've already seen reports which clearly seem to originate with the administration that this attack was also supposedly done by the Israelis. I'm afraid one has to get used to, one has to accept now that with this administration, the art of deception, if one can call it that, is being taken to almost unheard of levels, on levels unseen before, even in the post-Cold War history of the United States, or some would say the post-Second World War history of the United States. And incidentally, the president was up to it again with members of his entourage. He, at one point over the course of yesterday, appeared to throw his defense secretary, or war secretary if you prefer, Pete Hegseth, under the bus. He's suggesting that it was Pete Hegseth who had pushed the United States into the conflict with Iran, a conflict in which the United States doesn't appear to have thought things through. So it's all Hegseth's fault. Trump himself, after all, is only the President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief. One shouldn't really blame him if an operation of this kind doesn't go according to plan. It's all the fault of other people, including Pete Hegseth, who, of course, was the Secretary of Defense that he insisted on appointing. So anyway, an awful lot of that is going on. But to repeat again, one should look at what is actually taking place. There was another attack on a gas installation in Iran, and there was an immediate Iranian response, more Iranian missile strikes on the Israeli towns of Arad and Dimona. Dimona being, of course, the town where the reactor that plays such, the nuclear reactor, which plays such a critical role in Israel's nuclear weapons program, is located. Again, there is no word so far that the reactor itself was targeted or damaged. But there are lots of reports circulating about extensive damage done to the town of Arad. I've read reports speaking of tens of buildings in Arad hit by these Iranian missile strikes. Some of the Iranian missiles carry cluster munitions. I remember back in 2023, during the Ukrainian summer 2023 offensive, that the United States went against its stated policy and started to supply Ukraine with artillery shells with cluster warheads. I spoke out against it at the time. I said that this seemed to me a very wrong and very disturbing thing to do. I remember saying that this would set a bad precedent. And well, while we see that cluster warheads are being used on a much bigger scale by Iran, launching missiles at targets in Israel and doing apparently extensive damage with those cluster warheads. Anyway, there was this Iranian attack on Arad and Dimona, and that must also be treated as a further sign that we are in an escalatory spiral. And there have been more reports of further American military deployments to the Middle East. So there's now reports that a second group of US Navy Marines are heading to the area in another helicopter carrier. I discussed this in the past. There are other reports too of the first units of the 82nd Airborne Division arriving in the Middle East area as well. But reports have now started to circulate of much more substantial ground troop deployments altogether. Alongside the 82nd Airborne Division, the 101st Airborne Division, which is differently configured from the 82nd. As I understand it, the 82nd Airborne Division are pure paratroopers. The 101st Airborne Division is closer to an air mobile infantry force. It has rather heavier equipment. Again, if I am wrong about this, my apologies, and please do correct me on the threads of this video. But anyway, I understand that the 101st Airborne Division is also on its way. And perhaps more interestingly and more importantly, two US infantry divisions apparently are also being redeployed to the region as well. Now, again, I may be wrong, but I understand that the US military, the US Army, has 10 divisions altogether. If so, then four of these divisions, two infantry and two air mobile divisions, are heading towards the Middle East. Now, there is complete uncertainty as to what these divisions are supposed to do. There's been talk about capturing Harg Island. Many people have spoken about the problems of this. There's been talk about capturing islands in the Strait of Hormuz and of trying to break the Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz. There's all been lots of talk of this kind. Most people who understand or claim to understand about these things believe that the forces that are being deployed to the Middle East, the ground forces, which supposedly number around 20,000 men. Remember, two of these divisions are light infantry divisions, that they would not be adequate even for these sort of operations, capturing Harg Island or forcing open the Strait of Hormuz or capturing positions on the Iranian coastline. In fact, I saw an interview earlier today by a retired British Navy officer who said that that Iran has converted its coastline, much of which is mountainous and rocky, into a virtual fortress. And the worst thing that you can do is try to deploy ships, warships, against that kind of fortress. It would be incredibly dangerous to try to do that for those ships. And without the ships, I'm not really sure what all of these ground troops are supposed to do in a ground war against Iran, at least in the Persian Gulf area. Of course, it may be that there are plans to do other things in Kurdistan, for example. But I would have thought that the deployment of large numbers of troops and the logistics to sustain them in this rather more remote area would require many months of hard work before anything could be done. And in that case, we are indeed talking about a conflict dragging on until the middle to late autumn. Well, the important thing, perhaps, at this point is not to try to second guess whatever plans, assuming they exist, there are in the Pentagon or in the White House of a military nature. It is simply to make the point that for all the talk about negotiations that was taking place yesterday, the actual reality is that the United States continues to deploy more and more forces to the Middle East, to the conflict zone. That suggests, at least to me, that there is no real interest at the moment in negotiations, that the president and his officials, or at least those officials who are in the ascendant and who are giving him the advice which he is listening to, that the president and those officials are still focused on expanding and deepening the war. And of course, there have been other reports. There are reports in the Israeli media this morning that the administration has supposedly told the Israeli government that the military operation must end on the 9th of April. In other words, shortly after Easter, and that this is now the president's timetable, and that he plans a trip to Israel after the end of the military operation on the 9th of April. I have to say that that again reminds me of various claims that were made last year when the negotiations supposedly to bring the conflict in Ukraine were first starting. I remember that at that time, early last year, the word from the Trump administration was that the president wanted a ceasefire in the conflict in Ukraine by Easter. It seems that the president is in effect returning to the same timetable, to the same deadline, though this time in relation to the conflict with Iran. But just as I did not believe last year that there would be a ceasefire in the war in Ukraine by Easter, I don't believe that there will be a ceasefire by Easter this year in the conflict between the United States and Iran. So all of these military moves are taking place, and all of that talk about negotiations being underway, which we were listening to yesterday or hearing yesterday, to my mind, mostly it was phony. There was no substance or reality to it. On the contrary, we are looking at a longer, deeper, more prolonged war. Now, this is starting to cause wider, expanding concern. And one person who's spoken out strongly about this is the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. And he attended a meeting of the Gorchakov Fund. The Gorchakov Fund is a group in Russia focused on foreign policy and international relations questions. They take their name from the Imperial State Chancellor of the Russian Empire in the mid-19th century, Chancellor Gorchakov, who was one of the great figures of Russian diplomacy. Just then. Anyway, this is a big event in the Russian diplomatic calendar, and Lavrov attended it, and this is how the Russian news agency TASS, which is of course the official Russian news agency, discusses what he said. Lavrov noted that some international relations experts have already begun to refer to the conflicts unfolding around the world as World War III. And then TASS continues, Western elites continue to invest in confrontation with Russia. The Western minority, or rather the elites of Western countries, these are direct quotes, continue to invest whatever political and economic resources they have left in their confrontation with Russia. The Russian side is preparing for the next Russia-Africa summit in October, and some specialists, including those in Russia who study history, the history of international relations, have already begun to describe and characterize these events as World War III. Events that directly stem from the attempts of the Western minority of states to preserve the remnants of their dominance on the international stage using crude methods of force, regardless of any previously signed and ratified obligations under international law. Russia is concerned about what is happening in relations between Iran and its neighbours. Harsh military aggression by the United States and Israel against Iran risks destabilizing international trade and global energy security. The situation threatens to destabilize not only the Gulf region, which has already happened, and not only the entire Middle East, which is also happening, but also global trade, global energy security, and international transport and business communications. Russia is sharing its assessment of the current situation with both Iran and the member states of the Gulf Cooperation Council. We are currently discussing all these issues and, of course, sharing our assessments and the evolution of our views with both the Iranians and the member states of the Gulf Cooperation Council. Russia is convinced that the path of negotiations, the path of unity and balancing interests, is the one that serves the interests of the Middle East. And Lavrov then went on to say some very, very critical things, sharply critical things, about the International Atomic Energy Agency and the role that its director, Rafael Grossi, has played in bringing about this crisis. So here we have the foreign minister of one of the three great powers, perhaps, well, the single most experienced foreign minister in the world today, a person who is very widely regarded as being the world's leading diplomat, Sergei Lavrov, and he is talking about the events that are playing out around the world as the start of World War III, of a situation that is spiraling out of control. He talks again about aggression by the United States and Israel against Iran. He links this with the confrontation with Russia. He says that this all forms part of a single pattern of events in which the United States and certain of its allies in the West are pulling every stop, becoming increasingly reckless and desperate and violent and aggressive as they take ever more extreme steps to preserve and sustain their fading dominance. And perhaps at a more practical level, we see the mediation role that the Russians are actually engaging in, which is very different from the mediation role I have discussed in recent programs. The Russians are not trying to mediate between the United States and Iran. If Trump picked up the phone and called Putin and asked Putin, "Can you set up a meeting between ourselves and the Iranians to try to get some kind of negotiations started?" the Russians would probably be accommodating. But that isn't what the Russians are focusing on at the present time. What the Russians are doing is something completely different. Yes, they are trying to act as mediators, but not between Iran and the United States, not between Iran and Israel. The Russians have as little faith and trust now in the United States, and by the way, Israel, as the Iranians themselves do. Rather, what the Russians are trying to do is that they're trying to mediate between the Iranians and the member states of the Gulf Cooperation Council, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, the UAE. That's the mediation role that Russia is currently playing. And what the Russians almost certainly are trying to do at this present time is that they're trying to talk the Gulf states out of suggestions which apparently have been coming from the United States, from the administration. The Russians are trying to talk the Arab states out of starting, or rather joining, the war with Iran. And I saw some reports in the media in the West, I think they were in Bloomberg, but I might be wrong, in which the Gulf states showed that either this Russian mediation is having some effect, or more likely the Gulf states themselves have come to similar conclusions about the unwisdom of joining in the war with the United States and Israel against Iran for the Gulf states, as the Russians have done. Because these articles, and I've seen reflections of these comments also, by the way, in the Financial Times, apparently they're saying to themselves, well, the Iranians have acted deplorably. They are said to be furious with the Iranians, but they are also furious with the Americans also. They trusted and relied on American protection. They assumed that all of these bases that the Americans had established around the Persian Gulf would contain Iran and would protect the Gulf states from Iran. And what has happened instead is that the presence of those bases have made these countries a target, and the United States has shown that it is unable and unwilling to protect them. On the contrary, what it is trying instead to get them to do is to go further and deeper into the conflict on America's behalf, to go to war with Iran in a way that would expose these countries to further potentially devastating Iranian action. And given the way these states feel the Americans have left them in the lurch, it's understandable that despite the anger that exists towards Iran, that they're holding back and listening perhaps to what the Russians are saying and are choosing not to do it. As to the devastating consequences of these states going to war with Iran, I read an article in the American media, again I can't remember where exactly, but apparently there was a study done way back in the, I think it was 2008, about what might happen if there was an all-out war between the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia and Iran. And this looked at the possibility of the Iranians destroying the desalination plants in the Arabian Peninsula, which they unquestionably have the capability to do. The study concluded that in that case, within a week, a decision would have to be made to evacuate the Saudi capital, Riyadh, a city of 8.5 million people. Probably other cities would have to be evacuated as well. And though the report does not apparently go into the details, it casts doubt on the Saudi monarchy's ability to survive a crisis of that kind. Now, I am not myself saying this. That is my understanding of this article, which is based on a report, just to say. But to be clear, even if the Saudi monarchy were able to survive a crisis of that kind, it would be the biggest crisis by far that Saudi Arabia has faced since the founding of the kingdom more than a century ago. So one can understand why the Saudis and the other Gulf states, for all their anger, are holding back from what the president and the Americans want them to do. Anyway, this is where we are. Talk now from the Russians, and this isn't just any Russian, this is Lavrov. Talk from the Russians about the fact that we may be looking at the early stages of World War III. Everything is, in other words, out of control. And if these American military deployments do take place, and if some kind of operation does happen, military operation does happen, then that, of course, increases the chances of an even worse crisis. And, of course, if we start to see attacks on nuclear energy facilities, and by the way, the Iranians are also now apparently giving warnings of potential attacks on a nuclear power plant in the UAE. Anyway, if attacks on nuclear facilities take place, if we see further attacks on Bushehr in Iran and on Dimona in Israel, if these two reactors are attacked, well, a cycle of nuclear escalation begins to become possible, and then the whole situation is going to reach a stage which I don't want to think about or discuss in too much detail or in any detail in this program. At which point, talk about World War III will, it seems to me, become a practical reality. There are, by the way, some people in the United States who are already talking in ways that are not that detached from that. Newt Gingrich, for example, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, is talking about expanding the channel in the Gulf of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz, by using nuclear weapons. This is an extraordinary idea, straight out of Dr. Strangelove, just to say. Senator Lindsey Graham is busy also demanding, from what I can tell, all but unlimited escalation. He, of course, is now a fervid advocate of the Seas Harg Island plan. We are at an incredibly dangerous potential moment. In terms of the threat of nuclear war, perhaps more dangerous than any we have known since the Able Archer exercise in 1983, which, it must be said, was based on a misunderstanding, or perhaps more ominously since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, only we do not have rational, in-control actors like Kennedy and Khrushchev in overall charge, as we did at that time. So, I don't want to sound alarmist, but as I said, all that confident talk yesterday about negotiations really has no foundation to it. And it is about these other things that I have been talking about today that we should be concerned about. Now, before I move on, there is, unfortunately, another very ugly part of this story, the story of the negotiations, that I must address, because as has now been extensively reported across the international media, there's been a long discussion of it in the Financial Times. It is clear that some people anticipated, at least clear to me, that some people anticipated Donald Trump's statement yesterday that he was going to postpone for five days the ultimatum, the 48-hour ultimatum he had issued just a few days, hours before. And though there are different stories about the amounts of money that were the moves in the financial markets that were made in advance of that announcement, and of the sums involved, I've seen figures of $500 million and above being spoken about. And there's some uncertainty as to when some of these market moves were made. Some say 6 minutes before Trump's Truth Social post. Others say 15 minutes. But anyway, very, very close in timing to the truth, the publication of the Truth Social post. But frankly, all of the evidence clearly points to somebody or some people placing bets, if you like, or taking out positions in the markets in the expectation of the announcement that the president made. And this has inevitably led to speculation that the whole affair, from the moment of the 48-hour ultimatum announcement, right up until the moment of the president's Truth Social statement of yesterday, that all of this was an exercise in market manipulation intended to make certain people who clearly have information about the president's actions to make those people huge amounts of money. And inevitably, not so much in the mainstream media, but on social media, fingers have been pointed at the president himself. Now, I have no information about this. I don't know exactly what happened. I don't know who was involved. But this is very disturbing indeed. I think it absolutely requires proper investigation. I would have expected the law enforcement authorities to be taking an interest in it. I am concerned about the fact that there have been no word from the law enforcement authorities that they are in fact taking an interest in it. Regardless, this is, as I said, a spectacularly ugly episode, but it is no more ugly, in my opinion, than everything else that we have already seen. Anyway, there it is. This is the situation. This is where we are in the conflict today. Energy prices fell yesterday on the back of the president's announcement. They tumbled far. They, of course, have been rising back. I believe oil is again trading at above $100 a barrel. I've discussed the risk the president runs and his administration run of a credibility gap, of a situation, in other words, where nobody any longer believes a word they say. I think we are coming very, very close to that moment. I think what happened in the financial markets yesterday, and of course, all of those assertions about fictitious negotiations, negotiations that are not taking place, all of that has brought us much closer to that point still. In the meantime, again to repeat, the Strait of Hormuz remains closed. There's been a detailed discussion in The Economist, a magazine which, by the way, loathes and detests the government of Iran. Anyway, there's been a long discussion there about what might happen if the Strait of Hormuz were opened tomorrow. It would still take at least 4 months before the situation in the energy markets stabilized fully and returned to normal. Of course, if over the next few weeks we saw sustained attacks on energy facilities across the Middle East, and again, there have been articles that have been pointing to how extremely vulnerable some of these facilities, the energy production facilities, are. Well, we're not talking about a four-month crisis. We are talking about an all but indefinite crisis, one which is going to completely rearrange the global economic geometry, the global economic landscape. It is going to leave some powers much more powerful than other powers, and which is going to create an extremely deep crisis, especially in the global south, but in some of America's, among some of America's allies also. I understand that the first steps towards outright energy rationing have been made in Greece, my own home country. I don't pretend to be particularly well informed, but I understand that there are problems and stresses in many of the other countries as well, definitely in Britain. And it has been pointed out by any number of commentators in Europe that whereas in 2022-2023, European governments were still able to go into debt in order to cushion industry and domestic consumers from the effect of very high energy prices. This time, because of the acute state of indebtedness of many European governments, because of the extremely nervous state of the bond markets, that same action to spend money cushioning the blow of the higher energy prices by going into debt, that policy option this time is simply not there. I remember, by the way, warning back in 2022 that we might indeed eventually find ourselves in exactly that kind of situation in Europe. I said then that borrowing money to cushion against the effect of higher energy prices as a result of sanctions, which European governments themselves had imposed, was only a, was at best a one-off thing that would leave the financial and economic situation in Europe weakened. And of course, So it has exactly turned out, though, of course, not in ways that in 2022 I could have anticipated. Now, on this point about winners and losers, I read a series of very interesting articles, one and a long video program by the journalist Richard Medhurst, who, by the way, I ought to say that I slightly know, in which it suggested that the war that is being fought by the United States against Iran is actually going exactly according to plan. The plan being to basically destroy everybody's access to independent energy resources, to bring all remaining resources directly under the control of the United States. So, in the end, the objective is not even so much regime change in Iran, it is the destruction of Iran and of its energy system. And, well, if the Gulf states are also destroyed and their energy system doesn't work either, well, that works still to the long-term advantage of the United States because it remains the world's major, well, one of the world's major energy producers. I have to say that I find that too radical and too complicated for me. I don't believe that any US government would consciously go to war, prepared to lose it in order to achieve this grander objective. I certainly don't believe that Donald Trump or the leadership of the Republican Party would risk their political futures on that sort of project. And to say it straightforwardly, I think the very high energy prices that we're going to see are going to create major economic problems in the United States itself. They are not going to strengthen its position overall, its geopolitical position overall. They're only going to weaken it. And by weak, one way that though not the only way that they will weaken it is by weakening the US's allies in Europe and Asia. And that works against the United States because the reason the United States has been so powerful is because it leads an alliance of rich and powerful states, and if they become poorer and weaker, this undermines ultimately US power as well. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say on this topic. Now, elsewhere, the war in Ukraine goes on. And I haven't said very much about the war recently, and I'm not going to devote much of this program to it. It seems to me that it's almost a distraction now from this pressing issue, which is the conflict in the Middle East, which I would say I consider even more important than the war in Ukraine. But that doesn't alter the fact that we are getting a great deal of information from Ukraine and from the battle lines. And yesterday, we got an awful lot of information from Konstantinovka. I have been arguing for a long time that this town in western Donbass, at the southern end of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka conurbation, that this the maps that we have seen produced by the various mappers of the situation in this town is wrong, that the Russians almost certainly control a lot more of Konstantinovka than has been widely acknowledged. And yesterday, we got the first evidence of this. Video footage has been appeared showing Russian soldiers in various buildings deep inside central Konstantinovka in circumstances which suggest that the Russians now have control, maybe not total control, but overall control of the whole of the southwest of Konstantinovka, the major built-up area of the town, the place where there are the tall apartment buildings and many of the factories, the more modern part of Konstantinovka, which is the area which is easiest to fortify. There are still positions that the Ukrainians hold. There is still a village to the south of Konstantinovka, which is still under Ukrainian control. This is according to Russian sources. And one particular problem with capturing this particular village is that during the era of the Soviet Union, it was the location of a surface-to-air missile battery of the Soviet military. And though that missile battery was dismantled long ago, it was equipped, by the way, for those who are interested, with S-75 Dvina surface-to-air missiles, SAM-2 guideline missiles, very familiar to the US forces that fought in Vietnam, just to say. Anyway, though that particular missile battery was dismantled long ago, the fortifications that the Soviet military built around it still exist, and they provide a strong fortified position for the Ukrainians. But if one ignores, or overlooks perhaps more correctly, these isolated pockets elsewhere, southwest Konstantinovka seems to be falling or to have fallen under Russian control. Now, if this is correct, and by the way, I should say that for the record, I do believe it is correct, then I'm not going to say that the Battle of Konstantinovka is over, effectively over. There would still be some weeks of fighting to do, depending, by the way, on how much of the rest of the town the Ukrainians still hold. But anyway, it will become a lot more straightforward, because as one moves north and east, one in Konstantinovka, one leaves behind the high-rise buildings, the concrete buildings, one starts to enter residential neighborhoods made up of older, lower story buildings, some probably in this part of the world wooden. In other words, places that cannot be defended for very long. So it does look as if the Battle of Konstantinovka has indeed passed its most important point. Scott of Calibrated recently made the point, and I do consider him, by the way, to be the most informed and interesting mapper around. Anyway, he made the point that there is far too little attention given to the Battle of Konstantinovka in the various reporting sites that have been covering the war. Most probably this is because around 80% of the information that is out there about what is going on in the war derives ultimately from Ukrainian sources. And the Ukrainians do not want to talk about a battle in Konstantinovka that has been going very badly for them. But it does seem now that, as I said, we've reached this point where we can talk about the Battle of Konstantinovka coming to an end. Now, that, of course, weakens the line, the fortified line, based around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. The Russians further west have apparently now encircled the Ukrainian garrison in Belitskaya, though the Russian Defense Ministry has not confirmed it. Virtually all the bloggers and mappers accept that the Russians control Gryshino. It looks as if the Russians are soon going to be in a position to advance westwards, outflanking the Ukrainian defenders in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And of course, if the Russians control Konstantinovka, then the ability to do that is greatly simplified. The Battle of Donbass, the single biggest, most complicated, most difficult battle that the Russians have had to fight in the special military operation, is coming to an end. The Russians are now very strongly positioned in Zaporozhye region. They're very strongly positioned in northeastern Ukraine. They've taken positions close to the town of Sumy. They might eventually threaten Kharkiv. They could potentially advance on Kiev as well. In Zaporozhye region, as I've discussed, they are close. They're closing in on Orekhov. Beyond then, Zaporozhye, the city of Zaporozhye, is potentially in their sights. They could move beyond that and cross the river and advance if they chose all the way to Odessa. The linchpin of Ukrainian defense, what has held the entire Ukrainian defense line together up to now, has been Donbass and this line of fortified cities. Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, to a certain extent Druzhivka, and Konstantinovka as well. Konstantinovka has fallen. Pokrovsk and Mirnograd to the west have fallen. Before long, the remaining towns in this fortified line are going to be encircled as well. Quite likely, we're going to see the end of the Battle of Donbass by this summer, with months of the campaigning season for 2026 still to run, and with the Russians still having held back their reserves. I would just finish by saying there's been reports of another big Russian missile and drone strike on Ukraine last night, but I'm not up to date with this information, and I might touch on it in my program tomorrow. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.